We just marked the 75th anniversary of President Franklin Roosevelt signing the GI Bill into law. One of the leaders in pushing the legislation forward and getting the opportunities to returning soldiers was former U.S. Senator from Arizona, Ernest McFarland. The bill made an enormous difference when it came to helping improve access to education, home loans, and business loans. To learn more, I spoke with Lindsay Cormack, assistant professor at Stevens Institute of Technology and the author of Congress and U.S. Veterans, From the GI Bill to the VA Crisis. I started by asking about how much of an effort went into making the GI Bill a reality.
So at the time, it took about a year and a half from the conception of the GI Bill to the passage of the GI Bill. And you're right that it was a group effort. Ernest McFarland played a big role. But there was also, as there is today, lobbyists who helped draft up the original ones from the American Legion. And then other people in the Senate and the House who helped usher the bill. It was something that was controversial at the time. We had a problem with how we served the World War I veterans, and everyone could see that that probably wasn't going to work the second time around. But not everyone was set on thinking that the omnibus GI Bill that we ended up getting was a good idea from the get-go.
What were the arguments against it?
So one thing that concerned a few members was it was going to breed dependency on the government. At the time, there was this notion that, like, if the government was meant to pay for educational benefits, home loans, the ability for people to start their own businesses, they thought that maybe veterans would become too dependent on that sort of giving. That didn't come to be true, but it was something that some people who opposed the bill at the beginning, that was what they cited as their reason for doing so.
Many of us are very aware of the educational benefits from the GI Bill, but what are some of the other specific aspects of it?
So in the original GI Bill, there were two bills that were considered at first, and they were separated. One was having the educational benefits, and then others were talking about giving home loan benefits, as well as the ability to go to trade schools. And then in the final bill that we get, it's something that pieces together a bunch of different things. So people who benefited could use the money for tuition. They could use it to go learn a skilled trade. They could use it to go to flight school if they wanted to. They could also get a home loan based on credit that the government would issue to them in a beneficial way as veterans with interest rates capped at 4%. And so there's just a lot of different things. There's also some additional health care that is aside from the VA care that they were going to get via other mechanisms. But it was a really big bill that tried to deal with all sorts of things that veterans were going to face in a way that their civilian counterparts would not.
How open was it? Was it restricted to people of a certain background?
So that is a really interesting question. When the legislation was first being bandied about, FDR thought that it ought to be available only to means-tested veterans and actually to means-tested anyone. So anyone who didn't serve but was of the lifestyle that they weren't going to be able to afford these things on their own, he didn't understand why we didn't just give something like this sort of benefit to everyone. When it came to pass, one of the compromises, and I'd call it an ugly compromise, was made that said states would be able to administer the bill. And so it was the case that in the South, you had a lot of Black veterans who, by the law of the land, ought to be able to access these educational benefits. But in the way that Jim Crow worked, it was the case that state administrators wouldn't allow Black veterans to get the same sort of benefits as white veterans. And so that wasn't the intention if you look at the letter of the law. But in the negotiations that happened at the very end, it's very clear that the reason we allowed the states to administer this versus the federal government was to kind of let that sort of thing happen.
How much bang for the buck was there for this? Because it does seem as though this was beneficial in so many ways, not just to individuals, but overall in terms of how the country was able to make progress because more people had more opportunities.
It was incredibly successful. And the number that most people have kind of centered on is a 7-to-1, meaning for every $1 that the federal government spent investing in people, whether they're getting an education, that trade school, or a home, starting a business, we saw 7 additional dollars that were then tax revenue for everyone. And so this was something that was, at first, no one knew how successful it was going to be. They didn't know if veterans were going to even take it up in the first place. And it turned out to be something that probably saved us from another round of a depression that could have precipitated after World War II.
Does there need to be a perfect storm of sorts? It almost feels like World War II was a perfect storm in order for benefits to be more expanded or greater opportunity. And what comes to mind for me is the issue of education, for-profit schools, perhaps, quote-unquote, taking advantage of certain veterans who are not able to pay back and whatnot. Are we in a tough position now when it comes to even education is still so important for veterans, but it is hard to know who's sort of targeting them or who's making it work in the best possible way?
That is a really good point. And that's something that in an Arizona history way, Senator John McCain was really against these for-profit schools exploiting veterans for their GI Bill dollars. And that's something that Steve Cohen, who's a congressman out of Tennessee, just last week introduced some legislation to kind of ban for-profit schools benefiting from the GI Bill. Because sometimes it's really hard if you've come back from serving, or maybe you don't have a family who's used to higher education, it's hard to tell what is a good credentialed school versus one that's a for-profit school that might have really nice brochures, really compelling salespeople. And those schools, they set veterans up to fail, but they know that they're guaranteed GI dollars. And so that is like a really big spot that could be improved that I think a lot of legislators are aware of and working towards.
We have people on both sides of the aisle who certainly talk about support for veterans. That is a, in some ways, a feel-good thing to talk about that it's hard to disagree about. But do these members of Congress, for example, put their money where their mouths are? Is there truly a concerted effort to make sure that veterans and those who serve, that they're actually being cared for in a proper way?
So I think both of those things can be true. I think it is certainly possible to pay lip service to veterans without having done things for veterans. That being said, I have never met or seen any congressperson who's trying to actively act against veterans. Everyone likes to talk about our veterans in terms of their honor, their bravery, and there's not really a partisan slant to that. In terms of who's actually offering legislation, Democrats have a little bit of an edge. Even when Republicans controlled both houses towards the end of the Obama era, Democrats were introducing more legislation that benefited veterans, new legislation on women's veterans, suicide prevention, and things like that. And so both parties tend to valorize veterans, but it is the case that Democrats do a little bit more in legislating on behalf of veterans.
And that is Lindsay Cormack. She's assistant professor at Stevens Institute of Technology.